today on Against the Grain. What if everyone were entitled to, were guaranteed, a basic income so they didn't have to work to live? I'm C.S. Eric Olin Wright, a sociologist and leading radical thinker, makes the case for an unconditional basic income coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. It may sound weird, it may sound utopian, but an unconditional basic income is what many people have been advocating for years. You would not have to work to get this income. Everyone would be entitled to it, and in some scenarios, it's enough to live on. So what explains the appeal to many on the left of the basic income? Why have some conservative and libertarian thinkers embraced the idea? Would the economy collapse because most people would stop working? And to what extent would the adoption of an unconditional basic income facilitate or fuel a transition away from capitalism? Eric Olin Wright is a leading proponent of a basic income and a prominent radical scholar. He is a professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and his books include Understanding Class, Alternatives to Capitalism, and Envisioning Real Utopias. When Eric Olin Wright joined me in studio, I asked him when the notion of a basic income first caught his attention.
Well, it first caught my attention in the mid-1980s in the context of a gathering of intellectual sort of Marxist philosophers, sociology, economists, a group that met every year called the Analytical Marxism Group. Two of the members of that group were Philippe Van Parijs, a Belgian philosopher, sociologist, political scientist type, and Robert van der Veen from the Netherlands. There were two members of this group along with me and Jerry Cohen and a bunch of other people. And Philippe and Robert van der Veen wrote a paper called The Capitalist Road to Communism. Quite a famous piece published in the journal Theory and Society. I think published, maybe wrong, 1985 probably is the, maybe 86, right around mid-1980s. That was my first introduction to the idea of unconditional basic income. And in the context of the publication of that paper, I wrote a commentary for that journal, you know, which the commentary basically took the point why socialism is necessary, as a necessary condition for a basic income. That's what really got me engaged in this. And since then, I've written a number of pieces and been continually in discussions around basic income and its ramifications.
So in titling their paper, The Capitalist Road to Communism, were they suggesting then that something could be done within the framework of capitalism to move society in a communist, in a socialist direction?
Well, they specifically, it's of course meant to be a very provocative title, a little bit of a tease, because it shouldn't be taken too literally. By communism, in the context of the rhetoric of that paper, they meant a society governed by the two each according to need, from each according to ability formula. By socialism, they meant an economy in which the means of production were collectively owned or state-owned. And capitalism, they meant what everybody means by capitalism. So what they were basically arguing is that with an unconditional basic income that would provide in a serious way for the needs of everybody, people could just opt out of capitalism. So each person could choose whether to live in the capitalist world or the communist world. And then if most people liked communism over capitalism, the society would drift in that direction. It wasn't so much that it was a literal road to the whole society being communism. It was a road to people being able to choose to live in a world governed by the distribution principle to each according to need. And then they would contribute whatever they wanted according to their ability.
So what would an unconditional basic income, what would it basically entail?
All right. Well, the first thing to note is that the idea of unconditional basic income comes in a variety of flavors. And depending upon which flavor it means different things. For some people, an unconditional basic income is really a bare minimum survival income. You know, to use it a kind of metaphor, you don't starve if you have a basic income. Most progressives who embrace the idea think of it as a more generous idea, that a true unconditional basic income enables you to live at a culturally acceptable, decent standard of living, which would include, therefore, enough income to have recreation, but a kind of no-frills version. So you can perfectly comfortably get by with it, but if you really want to live a more extravagant lifestyle, then you have to earn additional income one way or another. So that's how I like to think of it. Certainly for the purposes that I defend an unconditional basic income, it's above a survival level.
And who, in your idea of the basic income, who provides this income and how often?
Well, it's, income means it's a flow. So it's more of a practical than a principled question of whether it's provided, so to speak, on a weekly or a monthly basis. Some versions give you an annual lump sum. I think that's probably not prudent just because of people's incapacity to budget well. So, you know, you think of it as a paycheck. So paychecks typically come on biweekly or monthly basis. It would be a flow of income along those lines. It's provided by the state, and it's paid for through taxation. Everybody gets it. Everybody. Bill Gates gets an unconditional basic income.
It doesn't depend on whether you work or any other criterion.
Right. Crucially, it doesn't depend upon how much money, how rich you are. The unconditionality has both a moral component, you don't have to be a good person to get it, and it has an economic component. It's not means tested. Now, of course, the taxes needed to pay for an unconditional basic income for Bill Gates are going to go up by many orders of magnitude more than the basic income he receives. So Bill Gates would be a net contributor. And there's lots of details about how that works. One should think of it in the same way we think of unconditional, or used to think perhaps of unconditional basic education. Everybody gets it. Some people are net contributors, that is, their taxes go up in order to pay for public education by more than they receive in public education. But that's seen as okay because it's a public good and it makes for a better society if everybody gets a basic education. Well, basic income has a bit of that character. Everybody benefits from it, even if you're a net contributor, because it creates a different kind of society, a society in which everybody has enough to live a morally decent or culturally acceptable standard of living.
So what impact would an unconditional basic income have on people's ability and inclination, really, to take a job, to go into the labor market and work for money?
Well, let me first clarify one other detail about the design, and that is who gets it. We said it's unconditional on means testing or on virtue. There is still the question of whether, for example, it's a citizen's income or a resident's income. That is, anybody who lives in a country, anyone under the jurisdiction of that state should get it. And if it's a resident's income, does it include undocumented workers? Now, to some extent, these are practical questions rather than principled questions. I mean, practical in the political sense. It's pretty hard to imagine an unconditional basic income ever passing, you know, even in pretty progressive places, that would include illegal residents. Everybody agrees that tourists shouldn't get it, you know. So somebody's coming to your country on a tourist visa, they don't, while they're there, get an unconditional basic income. I think on principle, it should go to everybody who's in the economy, in the labor market, in the labor force. That the question of how do you deal with the illegal migrants is a separate question, which needs resolution. We need ways of dealing with that. But that the moral principle of unconditional basic income is precisely that anybody who is on your territory participating in the economic life of your society should unconditionally have their basic needs met. In the most fundamental sense, I think an unconditional basic income should be for everybody in the world. I mean, I think you should have a global basic income.
Yeah.
And it should be globally redistributed. Well, that's certainly not on as a practical political move.
Eric Olin Wright joins us in studio. He is professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a leading radical thinker. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And we are talking today about unconditional basic income, which Eric has written a lot about and thought a lot about. So, yeah, back to this question of jobs and the necessity of having a job. So if the basic income, the unconditional basic income, provides you with a kind of culturally acceptable, no-frills existence, then is the whole idea that people would no longer need to go out onto the labor market?
The idea is that you don't need to go onto the labor market to get your basic necessities. So in the United States, roughly speaking, and, you know, vary from place to place because of cost of living, but think of an unconditional basic income as being in the $12,000 to $15,000 a year range, roughly speaking. Which would mean if two adults live together, they have a household income of $30,000. You'd have to think through the details about children. You know, do you get a partial basic income? How do you do it? Again, those are important details. We can put those to the side. So just take a couple. $30,000 in most places in the United States, you can live okay. But most people probably want more income than $30,000. So there'll be at least some reason why many, I think most people, will want to gain additional earnings. With an unconditional basic income, as soon as you earn additional income, you start paying taxes on the additional. There's no, the unconditional basic income isn't taxed. It'd be kind of directly. If all you live on is the basic income, you don't pay taxes, income taxes on that. But you start paying taxes on any earnings above your basic income. The tax rates will be higher. You have to figure out exactly where the cut point is, where you become a net contributor rather than a net beneficiary. But there's no disincentive to work. That is, you're not, the first $10,000 you earn above your basic income is not going to be taxed at 80%. You know, probably have a 15 or 20% tax rate on the first $10,000 you earn above the basic income. So the first thing to note is there's not a disincentive to work. And it's only people whose life plans are consistent with $15,000 or $30,000 if they're in a couple, whose life plans are consistent with that level of earnings, who will say, that's all I want. Now, there will be people, certainly people, for whom that's true.
But if they think that way, that is a disincentive to work. I mean, a lot of people are worried that so many people will take themselves out of the labor market that the economy might even collapse.
So just to be kind of technically precise, a disincentive means you're punished if you work. This would mean a lack of an incentive to work for them, right? So there's no, they don't feel any incentive to work because they feel no need to work. But there's no disincentive to work. With means-tested anti-poverty programs, there's an actual disincentive to work because you lose your benefits if you work, right? Okay, well, there's no disincentive then to work. Yeah, so a basic income is an unworkable plan if it's the case that the large majority of people really have as their deepest longings to be couch potatoes. So, you know, if the human spirit, contrary to what many of us believe, is really profoundly lazy, in the sense that we don't care about creativity. We don't care about making a contribution to our world and leaving our stamp with our, in some way or other. We really just want to watch soap operas, right? So if that is what we are at our essence, you give people $15,000, everybody stops working, the system collapses. Well, I'm being sarcastic, you know. This is a caricature. There will be some people, though, that will absolutely, you know, live a life of leisurely indulgence. Philippe von Paris, is one of his earliest and terrific pieces on this, is called Should Surfers Be Fed? Should Surfers Be Fed? And it's basically raising the standard big objection to basic income, that it will mean that people who work hard and generate the income that gets taxed for the basic income will be subsidizing beach bums.
But you could certainly, maybe with a basic income, you could be a beach bum, but you could also be productive in a way that's not profitable to you, right? That doesn't involve working for money. So for example, you've written about caregiving labor, and the fact is that many caregivers are not compensated at all. Well, this will allow them to do work, and you know, it's certainly not couch potato work. So they'll do work, that kind of work. They won't have a job for money, for pay. And so how does that work in the context of basic income? And to what extent is that a positive thing in your eyes?
Of course, it's an absolutely positive thing. There's a huge amount of socially productive labor that contributes to human flourishing, both of the person performing the labor and to other people in their lives. So there's lots of activities of that sort which would expand under an unconditional basic income. It gives people, in a sense, the possibility of saying no to capitalist employment and saying yes to all the other socially productive, interesting things, constructive things people can do. So caregiving would be one sort of obvious example, both for elder care and for children and disabled care. But so would the arts. An unconditional basic income might increase the number of bad poets in the society because it would enable more people to say, I want to try to be a poet, and not all of them will be good poets, so to speak. But it enables people to engage in the arts in a way that they can't if they have to be preoccupied with earning a living. Unconditional basic income also has a very interesting effect with respect to agriculture. So agricultural subsidies in the world in which we live now are justified on the grounds that they enable small farmers to exist. The rhetoric around the defense always has the image of the small family farm. But overwhelmingly, agricultural subsidies, both here and in Europe, so this isn't just an American pathology, everywhere goes to agribusiness, goes to big, wealthy investors in agriculture, not to family farms. So imagine the following. Just get rid of all agricultural subsidies, zero subsidies targeted to agriculture, but give people unconditional basic incomes. Suddenly, small family farms become quite viable because the farmer then is only producing for discretionary income. They're not producing their core income. They're just producing their discretionary income, which means that they can devote full time to farming if they want. And farms that were shaky and marginal before, because the family had to also engage in paid labor in the city, you know, typical kind of problem for small farmers, suddenly become viable. As a prediction, I think an unconditional basic income will increase the number of people engaged in agriculture. It will provide a kind of grounding, not to mix my metaphors, for urban agriculture in some places, because it means that people can engage in a more serious and intensive form of community gardening and urban agriculture because they don't have to generate their full livelihood out of it. And it would lead to an absolute expansion and enrichment of the arts.
What about the situation of paid workers, so people who do go out and get jobs? What do you think an unconditional basic income would do to their situation?
Well, it's a little unclear. You know, there are ambiguities. On the one hand, really crappy work that people hate doing, which also in the current world is often badly paid work. One possibility is such work would become more expensive. That is, employers offering the job of picking strawberries, you know, I'm using that as a metaphor. I don't know enough about the technology of picking strawberries to know if this is still true, but it used to be the kind of example of backbreaking labor that had very high rates of occupational injury because of the necessity of bending over so much. It'd be very tough to get people to do strawberry picking, so strawberry picking would become more expensive. On the other hand, there's lots of jobs that people really love, and if they had $15,000 guaranteed, they might be willing to do it for less.
Interesting.
I think with an unconditional basic income, the natural thing to do is to get rid of all minimum wage laws. There's no need for them. You know, so if you really want to do something for $5 an hour, because it's great fun, it's meaningful, and that's what the employer is able to pay, go for it if you have the $15,000. Now, some people, particularly some of my comrades on the left, get queasy about basic income when they think, maybe this is a subsidy for low wages. It just makes it easier for the scoundrels to pay little. On the other hand, since the exit option for workers is always there, they can say no. The fact that it ends up being a subsidy for low wages means that those low-wage jobs are attractive for other reasons. And I don't think that the kind of the moral dilemma around subsidizing low-wage labor in the sense of it being exploitative, I don't think it has the same bite under conditions where workers really have the exit option. They can say no to it.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Eric Olin Wright joins me. He is Vilas Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's author of many books, including Understanding Class, Envisioning Real Utopias, and Alternatives to Capitalism, Proposals for a Democratic Economy with Robin Hanel. And I and Eric want you to know that many of Eric's books are available for free online. We've put a link on our webpage at kpfa.org. Just go to kpfa.org/programs and click on Against the Grain, and you'll find a link to Eric's website where you'll find links to, PDF links to, many of his publications. So essentially what you're saying is that workers have more power, they have greater leverage in relation to employers under a system with unconditional basic income. And is that part of the reason, how big a part of the reason that you support unconditional basic income is this, that there are unequal power relations in capitalist society and that a goal, an important goal of a movement for social justice ought to be to adjust and transform those power relations?
Yes, certainly. That, if you really play out the logic, that's probably the most fundamental issue for me, is its effect on power relations. But I think one needs to think of it in the following slightly more nuanced way. One can think of the redress of the imbalance of power of capitalism either in terms of the collective power of workers via their organization. That's classically how we do it. We argue workers are individually weak, but collectively they can be quite strong. And labor unions have been the principal form of such collective power of workers. And in sometimes in places, political parties that are either explicitly linked to the labor movement or at least implicitly linked to the labor movement, collective power. Unconditional basic income has a particularly strong effect on the individual power of workers. That is their ability to say no, which is a individual ability. You can walk away from a deal. That gives you power. It increases, therefore, their individual autonomy and capacity to do things. That has a second-order effect on their collective capacity. But it has a potential positive effect on their collective capacity. It could conceivably weaken their collective capacity because they don't care about it as much. You know, if individuals can say no, why do we need a union? Unions have traditionally been very hostile to unconditional basic income. It's not part of the traditional union view. What unions want is to strengthen their negotiating power with employers in order to get a better wage bargain, among other things, with capitalist employers.
Is there a scenario in which you see unconditional basic income actually improving or augmenting the strength of unions?
Well, it could if there are grounds for solidarity that can be sustained, because you can think of unconditional basic income as an unconditional strike fund, too. It means workers could collectively refuse to work because they want improved working conditions or whatever, and the union doesn't have to have a strike fund because every worker has an unconditional basic income. Well, an unconditional basic strike fund is certainly something which would increase the negotiating power of unions, but only if workers also joined and voted for and backed unions. And I think on that score, it's ambiguous. I wouldn't want to sell basic income to unions on the grounds, look, support this because it's going to increase the power of unions. It might, but it could, in fact, undercut the power of unions.
Well, yeah, let's talk about political activity and the potential for progressive or radical political activity in a nation that has unconditional basic income. So what impact do you think such an income might have on, you know, political activity, community organizing, social movements?
So the most obvious effect would be to provide a massive basic political income, you know, activism income. It means that people can be community activists in all sorts of ways without having to, apply to nonprofits, to foundations, to find activist groups that happen to have angel donors. You know, they basically have an unconditional basic income that would support community activism. What I think one can say with kind of a simple, straightforward prediction is that locally oriented problem-solving activism in a grassroots sense, that would increase. Some of that will have quite progressive characters, but it would also mean that people involved in faith-based, church-oriented good works would increase. So exactly how that plays out politically, I think, is another ambiguity. So that's for sure. Now, whether it also contributes to a more coherent progressive politics, not just local activism doing good stuff, that, I think, doesn't follow one way or another from basic income. If there are social forces engaged actively in the solidarity work and the political work around those broader movements for change, then a basic income makes their job easier. If those don't exist, I don't think a basic income triggers their existence.
Eric Olin Wright, Vilas Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We are talking today about unconditional basic income, which is an income unconditionally paid to all on an individual basis without means testing or a work requirement. It's a minimum income guarantee with no strings attached. We'll take a short break and speak more with Eric. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Eric Olin Wright is my guest. He teaches sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is a leading radical thinker. We're so happy to have him join us in studio. His books include Classes, American Society, How It Really Works, co-authored with Joel Rogers, and Deepening Democracy, co-authored with Arkan Fung. And much of his academic work has focused on reconstructing the Marxist tradition of social theory and research to make it more relevant to contemporary concerns. So, unconditional basic income is not just a proposal of the left or the far left. In fact, some people on the right, some conservatives, some libertarians have advocated a basic income. So I have to ask you about their perspectives. Now, Charles Murray, best known for co-authoring the very controversial book, The Bell Curve, actually advocates giving $10,000 per year tax-free to every adult over 21, or at least he did in a book and in several writings he's written over the years. What do you think of his proposal?
Well, the key to his proposal is what you eliminate to fund it. Now, every basic income does replace some programs. If you have the kind of basic income that I support, which would be modestly generous, you would get rid of unemployment insurance. You don't need unemployment insurance. You might also get rid of Social Security, retirement pensions, publicly funded pensions. There's no particular reason why you need a publicly funded pension if everybody has a basic income throughout their whole life. So you save quite a lot by getting rid of anti-poverty transfers and so on. The general view of progressives is you get rid of nearly all cash transfer programs, but not everything else. You still need universal health insurance. We don't even have that. You need universal public education. You need all sorts of other publicly provided services that contribute to human flourishing. And basic income just deals with one piece of a person's standard of living, that part of your standard of living that comes from the income, the money you have at your disposal. Charles Murray wants to get rid of almost everything else. I was in a discussion with him at one point in which he made the following claim, that his first best option was to have no basic income and nothing else. You know, he wants to get rid of all state funds for egalitarian social support, risk reduction. He thinks there should be no public insurance and virtually no public services. And his belief is that private charity would deal with the deserving poor. Anybody who is suffering for no fault of their own will be taken care of by charity, in his view. And the incentive for charity is squeezed out when the government does it. That's his perspective. So get rid of everything would be his first choice. But then he says, well, he knows that's not politically possible. So the second best is get rid of everything and then put back a survival income, a bare survival income. But then people still have to buy health insurance. They have to buy all the other services that previously were provided by states. So that's a really nasty proposal. It's using basic income as a cover for just dismantling the role of the state to deal with the harms of a capitalist economy.
What about the argument that a basic income would minimize the opportunities for political rent seeking and opportunism, because it would stop being the case that, you know, those who make the strongest political case or who are best at manipulating the system would get the most out of the system, would get the most back from the government?
Well, it's an optimistic view that giving everybody a basic income would automatically undercut the power of corporations to get special deals for themselves. I see no obvious reason why the tax loopholes that corporations get for special privileges disappear just because you have a basic income. I think what one might believe, there may be good reason to, is the political context in which a universal, unconditional, generous basic income was enacted would also be a context in which corporate welfare would be eliminated as one of the ways of helping to pay for it. But there's nothing intrinsic in an unconditional basic income that eliminates rent seeking as such.
I want to return to something you said earlier. So if increasing the collective power of labor versus capital is one of your primary goals in advocating for an unconditional basic income, and if you're not sure whether the collective strength, not the individual strength, but the collective strength of workers will be augmented by an unconditional basic income, because, you know, workers might have higher individual leverage over employers but not necessarily want to join unions or strengthen unions, then I'm not sure what accounts for your support, your continued support for the income.
Okay, so let's go through some steps to get to this point. The reason I strongly support rules of the game that increase the collective power of labor is because it's part of a bigger package of wanting to transform capitalism, and in particular, wanting to transform capitalism in a way that points beyond capitalism. The rhetoric I use these days when I talk about this is that if you're opposed to capitalism, there's a variety of strategic visions you can have. You can have a vision of smashing capitalism. That's the ruptural revolutionary tradition. You can have a vision of taming capitalism. That's the social democratic idea of neutralizing its harms. You can have a vision of escaping capitalism, the sort of hippie in the woods solution. Or you can have a vision of eroding capitalism by building alternatives in the spaces where that's possible, and then engaged in struggles to expand those spaces. Build the future you want in the places where you can in the present and expand them through struggle. Now, the eroding capitalism requires changes in the rules of the game as well. Unconditional basic income is attractive because it's a change in the rules of the game about how people gain access to livelihood. It's a different kind of capitalism with an unconditional basic income than without it. But it unleashes the potential for people to engage in the process of building other kinds of economic systems inside of capitalism. They have the freedom to build a different world in the present. It would increase what's often called the social and solidarity economy. It would increase all sorts of cooperative enterprises. It would accelerate, and this is might seem a little odd thing for a leftist to say, it would accelerate automation and the elimination of paid work in certain sectors because it becomes expensive since people don't want to do it. Well, that's actually a good thing. It's a good thing to get rid of work that people don't want to do if the only reason they do them is because they don't have an exit option. So you give them an exit option, you automate this stuff, but the people whose time and effort is liberated by that automation then can, if social forces are encouraging them in various ways, build alternatives. So that seems to me, in the long term, if we want to ask, what would it take to move beyond capitalism? If you don't think that a revolutionary rupture is any longer a plausible scenario, which I don't think that there's a plausible scenario in which you can seize power and smash the power of the capitalist class in some ruptural moment. I just think that's implausible, both because I don't see a scenario to get to the point where you could attempt it, but the attempt itself would blow up in your face and produce a world other than the world that we want. So if smashing capitalism is just not plausible, then eroding capitalism is the only prospect for its fundamental transformation. And basic income underwrites that dynamic, potentially. But like everything, I think, it has this contradictory quality. And thus, it would become a crucial problem to be solved. How can we reconstruct the collective agency of people to act politically? It becomes less important for them to act against employers at the point of production. That ceases to be the main site at which struggle is needed. But the struggle in the society over the rules of the game, over the state, is every bit as important, if only to defend the basic income and to make it a generous as opposed to a miserable one. You know, that requires collective action. And that is a problem. That is a problem. And it's a problem for which I don't have any magic wand solutions. But I think a capitalism with a generous basic income is a better terrain upon which to work on that problem than the capitalism we have today.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm speaking with Eric Olin Wright. He teaches sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's a leading thinker on the issue of unconditional basic income, which again would be an income unconditionally paid to all individuals, all residents of a certain nation, paid by the state, no means testing, no work requirement, no, you know, determination that your total wealth is below a certain figure. And it would, at least in some perspectives, according to some perspectives, including Eric's, it would provide for a basic, culturally acceptable, no-frills existence. Well, I guess it wouldn't be a basic income if it were means tested, but why not means testing? Why not just say, look, if you have less money than X amount of money, we'll give you this basic income unconditionally, you know, having only one condition that you really need the money, and rich people will just leave alone. We won't give them any income. We won't give them a check every week or month.
Well, that's a bit like saying if your income is above a certain level, your kids should pay tuition for elementary school. There's something about the universalizing of the right. Every kid goes free, but the rich people pay more taxes. Indeed, the rich people are paying for the schooling, but in a form that is not assigning it to the point of entry into schooling. There's a variety of reasons to make it unconditional. One is, if it's unconditional, there's no line of demarcation between who gets it and who doesn't. If you create a line of demarcation, the political tendency will be for it to drift downwards. It fractures solidarity between recipients and contributors. And furthermore, it misinforms people because it makes it seem like if you're above that threshold, you're not benefiting from the basic income. The basic income is insurance for everybody. It means that you can make choices in your life knowing that you've got that basic income. You can take time off. You can take a sabbatical, in a sense, if you're willing to cut back on your expenses. The other thing which is very important about this is that an unconditional basic income is incredibly efficient administratively. You don't have to worry about people hiding income. You don't have to worry about scams. You know, there'll be some fraud people who will try to collect two basic incomes by having phony identifications or something. Of course, there'll be any system's going to have ways for people to get around the rules. But it's really simple. Everybody gets the check. Everybody gets the flow of income. The deadweight overhead costs of running an unconditional basic income are really low. Means testing adds a level of monitoring. You have to check on everybody. Are you or are you not eligible? Some people say, we should have it be unconditional, except that everybody has to do some kind of contribution to the society, just to avoid the parasite problem. But again, that creates an enormously difficult monitoring problem. What counts as a contribution? How are you going to observe it? How do you avoid phony contributions, et cetera, et cetera? So one of the attractions of the unconditionality is its simplicity. Let me just add one thing here in terms of the rhetoric around unconditional basic income. There are a variety of different defenses of it, reasons why people say, ooh, that's a great idea. Philippe Von Paris, who I consider the deepest thinker about the philosophical foundations for a basic income, his position is what one might call a left libertarian position. It's or an egalitarian liberal position. What he argues is that unconditional basic income takes really seriously the value of freedom, which most people in Western democratic capitalist societies believe is a good thing, freedom, individual freedom. But it says the only way that we can have real freedom for all is if everybody has a basic income. So it's an egalitarian distribution of resources in order to create an egalitarian distribution of freedom. It really just says for freedom to be meaningful, you have to be able to make choices. And above all, you have to be able to say no to things that are harmful to you. And that's what an unconditional basic income does. It enables people to say no to bad employment. It enables people to say no to bad marriages. Women in particular, under the current conditions, the capacity to exit a marriage increases by virtue of the guarantee of the resources independently of any obligations. So Real Freedom for All, that's the title of his famous book on the topic, I think is the foundational justification, and that also justifies its unconditionality.
Let's talk about its political feasibility. I mean, do you see this scheme, this system of unconditional basic income being feasible in, well, I should say this nation, but any nation in the near future?
Well, in the United States, where unconditional basic health isn't even feasible in the near future, you know, when we got close to being able to possibly have a breakthrough, the patchwork system that was the only one that could pass through the political system still left huge holes in the insurance system. So certainly the United States is not a fertile ground for any progressive breakthrough. There are other places in the world where this is being actively discussed, thought about. In Finland, it's part of the political agenda. In Switzerland, there's going to be a referendum on unconditional basic income, I believe, in 2017. The rates that's being discussed in those countries is in the order of magnitude of 1,000 euros a month. So that's, you know, in the $12,000, $13,000 range. So yes, it's on the agenda. It's on the agenda in the United States, for that matter, in surprising ways. I gave a talk in San Francisco, and when I mentioned basic income in the context of the broader themes of my talk, the audience broke into spontaneous applause. Now, I can tell you, as an experienced academic who's given many talks in many places, that's practically the only time I can remember in the middle of a talk spontaneous cheering and applause for invoking some abstract idea. So clearly something is bubbling up. Now, partially what's bubbling up is the idea that the trajectory of employment in highly productive, technologically advanced capitalist economies, the trajectory looks pretty grim for providing not just employment, but decent employment for the large majority of the population. There's lots of data to support that the increasing polarization and inequality that we observe on the earnings side of the equation is not just on the nature of the flows of income, but on the character of the jobs available in the economy. And, you know, there are dire predictions about automation basically destroying all jobs. Those kinds of apocalyptic views, I think, are overstated. But it is certainly true when people think about the future of work and paid employment that the trajectory in the future does not look promising.
So kind of the inability of advanced capitalist nations to generate a sufficient number of jobs that pay reasonably well, I mean, that inability ought to incline policymakers, in your opinion, toward this idea of a basic income?
So it's one of the fixes that could get onto the agenda because of those conditions, yes. So generally speaking, my perspective on what are the conditions under which radical reforms that open up new progressive possibilities, what are the conditions in which they can occur and be stably instituted? One of the conditions, I think, which makes such breakthroughs stable is if they also solve a problem for elites. That it's not just that your capacity to mobilize forces the state to make a concession that's good for the masses of people. If that's all that's going on, then as soon as that mobilization dies back, as soon as people relax or as soon as the political moment passes, then those reforms are vulnerable to reversal. So the conditions under which I think a radical reform has the possibility of becoming stabilized is if it also solves a problem from the point of view of dominant classes and groups, rather than just serves the interests of popular forces. And basic income, I think, has that character. It solves a problem of the inability to generate good employment, and therefore an inability to generate the necessary earnings for people to buy the stuff that capitalists make, right? So there's a kind of Keynesian face to the unconditional basic income.
And as a way of summing up, I know we've touched on these rationales, but I know you wanted to emphasize kind of three central rationales or defenses for unconditional basic income on the left, on the progressive left.
So the simplest and most straightforward that I think draws people most directly to unconditional basic income as an idea is that it solves a pressing problem, poverty in the midst of plenty. You know, we're an advanced capitalist society, incredibly productive, producing huge amounts of wealth, and yet we have poor people. Well, unconditional basic income provides this simple mechanism for simply saying enough is enough. Let's set the basic income above the poverty line. Everybody has enough at that basic level. So anti-poverty and the injustice of having poor people in a rich society, I think, is probably the motivation or the rationale that draws most progressives towards basic income. The second defense of basic income is the defense that Philippe Van Parijs has emphasized, real freedom for all. Now, the real freedom for all argument applies even if you've solved the poverty problem just by giving lots of means-tested and special programs and Medicaid and food stamps. So nobody is really destitute. They still don't have the kind of autonomy that would come from simple, unconditional basic grant. Real freedom for all says everybody should be free to make choices on without the constraint of having to look for work. So that you could think of as the left libertarian or the liberal egalitarian, that's another way of thinking about it, defense. So anti-poverty, real freedom for all. And the third argument, which is the one that I've emphasized, I indeed endorse all three arguments, but the third argument which I emphasize is that unconditional basic income opens a space for a new kind of dynamic in a capitalist market economy, which makes it possible, but not inevitable, but possible for people to build non-capitalist relations of production, to build within the sort of fabric of the existing society an alternative society with more emancipatory spaces. And then whether or not those spaces are filled by interesting and progressive productive activities, that depends upon how people respond. And the collective action and community solidarities, grassroots activism, all these things will determine the extent to which those spaces are filled and then what obstacles those spaces face and how we transcend those barriers. So my third then rationale is not the static one that it gives people more choice right now, nor the anti-poverty one. It reduces suffering in a world where that's not necessary any longer, but a dynamic argument that it sets in motion a different kind of social dynamic that pushes against the boundaries of capitalism in new and hopefully productive ways.
Eric Olin Wright, Vilas Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and his books include Understanding Class, Envisioning Real Utopias, and Alternatives to Capitalism, Proposals for a Democratic Economy with Robin Hanel. And again, many of his books are freely available online via his website, and we've put a link to his website on ours at kpfa.org. Just go to kpfa.org/programs and click on Against the Grain, and you'll see the link with today's program. Eric, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.